In his book, The Journey Matters, Jonathan Glancy travels from the early 1930s to the turn of the century on some of what he considers to be the most truly glamorous and romantic trips he's ever dreamed of or made in real life. What a brilliant idea for a book. Jonathan, morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Yeah, boy, it must have been hard to pick just 20, I would have thought.
Very difficult to fit 20. I mean, I could write the book 10 times over, which
yeah.
I won't. But I could do a second volume, I guess, because there's so many journeys that one dreams of doing. I don't know if any of your listeners have ever done that thing I've done lots of times. You're lying in a hotel bedroom that's unfamiliar, and you can't quite get to sleep. Too many thoughts going through your head.
Yep.
Just unfamiliar situation, so on. And then you start thinking, drifting off, thinking about journeys you may have made or would like to make. And I go to sleep thinking of wonderful journeys by sea or by air or by train that I couldn't have made because, of course, I wasn't born there a long time ago. But I love the idea of trying to recreate them in loving detail. And it's a lovely way of drifting off to sleep.
Oh, what a great idea. What a lovely thing to do. Even your dog agrees with you by the sound of it in the background.
Yeah, right? I know. I've got a chat, Russell, in the background, who's so noisy that I said as soon as I start speaking on live radio, he'll start shouting. And he's been quiet all morning.
Jack Russell's like travel. We used to have a Jack Russell once in the Isle of Wight, and he got on a train at Sandown and ended up in Portsmouth. He got off the train, onto the ferry, and ended up in Portsmouth Harbour. So that's quite impressive, actually.
They love it. If you look in the book, you'll see early on in one of the first pages, the dedication is to Don Pedro, which sounds very Spanish.
Yes.
And Don Pedro, who started off as El Pedro, was my beautiful, beautiful bulldog.
Oh.
Pedro was my rock, of course, is what it means.
Yeah.
Pedro means a rock. Pedro's my rock. But the thing is, he travelled everywhere, and he loved sailing, and he used to come on sailing boats, rowing boats, and big ferries. And one of the chapters in the book is actually dedicated totally to Pedro. It's a journey that takes us from London through northern Germany and then to Finland across the Baltic on one of the big Finnish ferries.
Fantastic.
Which are full of lorries, coaches, but they took dogs in style.
Yeah.
And so Pedro there, he travelled across, the crew loved him.
Oh.
And I was thinking that then, wasn't it nice when we could travel so easily, like Tintin used to do in those cartoons
with
Snowy? And he used to travel everywhere with his dog. These days, you can't take your dog on the Eurostar train. You can't get, you know, across from England to the continent, setting up down to France or Spain with your dog. You've got to drive. And I think that's a bit of a pity, really.
Yeah, though they do allow them here in restaurants. I was out with some friends on Saturday night and I had a yapping tiny dog on either side of our table, which was quite irritating, I've got to say. I like dogs, but not when I'm eating.
Not when you're eating. And by the way, in this book, eating and drinking plays quite a large part, because one of the things that I miss and travel, and I can only just really remember from my own, is that wonderful sense of style that you've got on day-to-day trains, for example, or in airplanes, you know, where, you know, even a normal express train, whether it's in Spain or France or England or Scotland, you know, would have a dining car.
Yes.
You know, sit down and get waiter service. I mean, today, when people are traveling on these, you know, crowded commuter trains, which can be very long distance, you know, people commute for 2 hours a day either way, standing up around most of the tail.
Absolutely. There's nothing glamorous about that. Absolutely not.
Nothing glamorous indeed, but there used to be tremendous... So what I wanted to say in this book is that, you know, every journey matters. And although there's some super glamorous journeys in this book, going back to the 1930s, it does say that there are also those journeys that are quite matter-of-fact that can be very, very special and delightful. So one of the journeys in the book, for instance, is just riding a London bus in 1958 from Liverpool Street in the City of London to Hammersmith. The point is, everything about the bus itself and the adventure you've had on it was really first class, if you like.
Yeah.
You know, I love that.
Absolutely.
Everyday journeys can be first class.
And as you say there, even trains, you know, I remember very vividly as a child standing in Glasgow Central Station, this is back in the 60s, watching steam trains come in and out of the station, just amazing. And to be on one was just, as a kid, it was just unbelievable.
Yes, I think that you'll notice in the book there are several steam trains. And the reason for that, I think everybody except a miserable person will agree. A steam train is like a mobile weather system. You know, it's a wonderful machine for producing clouds of steam. It has a heart, it has a soul, it has a wonderful rhythm. And when you're traveling on an express steam train, and there's just very few left in the world, it's a magnificent experience because it's sense you're around, isn't it?
Yeah.
All your senses are engaged. Whilst a lot of normal trains today, they may be very efficient, but they are dull.
Absolutely.
And this book is about journeys that aren't dull.
Oh, totally. That isn't the 8:45 from Portsmouth Harbour to London Waterloo, calling it Guildford, Woking, Hazelmere, Petersfield. Yeah, it's certainly...
You sound as if you know that well. And at the moment, of course, those trains are on strike for a month up to Christmas, so you won't even be able to go on it. But also, I guess you're based in Spain, aren't you? And where are you?
We're in southern Spain on the Costa del Sol, but I've travelled here since I came here on the wonderful high-speed AVE train, which is absolutely brilliant, I've got to say.
Yes.
And it makes the British rail system look like it's back in the 40s.
It does. So in the book, I do say that not all the glamour has gone. And I do say that the high-speed train services... that have appeared in the last 25 years really are great, which they are.
Yeah.
I mean, the AVE are superb. Although, by the way, I think one of the best journeys in Spain, and one I've done three times, is along the northern coast, along the Atlantic coast.
How wonderful.
You know that one? Has anyone done that? The narrow gauge lines of Glasgow to Ferrol, and you go right, you go from the Basque country to Galicia, and you go along through Cantabria, Asturias, and you've got the Pecos Mountains on one side, you've got the beaches, seas, forests, viaducts, rivers. It's so exciting, and it's all on a humble little trains that cost the whole journey, by the way. I mean, it's about, gee whiz, it's nearly 300 miles, and the journey costs about 60 euros.
Wow,
I mean,
how wonderful.
And yet they're basic little trains, you know, little meter gauge trains.
Yep.
But, wow, I mean, you have... one of the most exciting experiences you can.
That sounds brilliant, actually. That sounds right up my street. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? And people have been on that, say, talked to me about it and said, what do you mean, Jonathan? Doesn't that take ages? I said, yeah, I mean, if you want to do it non-stop, the journey from Bilbao to Ferrol takes about 13 hours.
Yep.
But you can get on and off wherever you want.
Yep.
And on the way, as you know, in the most beautiful villages, little towns, villages, and you can eat at wonderful places, go to vineyards, go to see cider farms, you can go walk. It's beautiful. And go to the beach.
Wonderful.
Climb up the mountains the other, or buy a little narrow gauge, state-owned train at very low cost.
How fantastic. Aircraft. Now, I'm lucky enough to have a pilot's license, and the days, that's nice to know, and back in the days of Imperial Airways, from Southampton and onward to Singapore, and even further onwards than that, that is when they're landing and taking off in the Solent, basically, isn't it? They're flying boats.
I think one of the most romantic journeys I can possibly imagine by air is one I've written about in the book, which is, I've set it in just before the Second World War and the fall of Singapore, but it's from Southampton to Singapore by one of the Imperial Airways flying boats.
How
and
amazing.
I think what's terrific about it, isn't it? Every evening the plane lands on a lake or by the coast at a port, and then you, the passengers, not many of you, of course, you're transferred to a hotel. Now, that hotel can be super luxury, as it was, say, for example, in Athens, overlooking the Parthenon, or it could be in a military compound down in Basra or something like that, where the British military would look after you, and you whilst you sat down and ate a chicken curry in the heat, 50 degrees centigrade heat outside. But then the plane took off again and crossed India, but flying at as low as 200 feet.
How amazing. So
you could see people down below washing their saris in the rivers. You could see, see tigers.
I mean, incredible.
And the pilots would have the freedom to be able to slightly, not go off route, but just a circle around a bit. If the passengers looking out of the window on the promenade deck said, gosh, look, we can see tigers, the pilot could then do a circle. And because, of course, they kept time, but they had that luxury, which we don't have now,
of
a much freer air route. There's nothing there in front of you, apart from, of course, thunderstorms, sandstorms.
Yes, I can't imagine the pilot saying, we'd like to enter a hold at 200 feet because we've just seen a tiger these days and getting away with it. No.
No, right. So your listeners, that I would imagine one or two of them, if not lots of them, might use cheap budget airlines to fly backwards and forwards from Spain to England, for example.
Yep.
And we all know what that's like. There's no point in me going on about that because we all feel the same about those experiences.
Yeah, it's cheap. That's all you can say about it.
It's cheap. And it's truly, they are, you know, we travel on an Airbus. And the name is right, isn't it? It's just a bus with wings. And the crew are great. You know, they're working, they're proficient, they're hardworking. You know, they keep you safe. And that's it. And it's dirt cheap. But the difference between that and flying across India at 2,000 feet.
Wow.
The other thing, you know, those aircraft, they would land in lakes in India. There's two great lakes they would land in. And you went the passengers that wanted to could go swimming in the lake.
Oh.
I mean, so you saw, and then you get back onto the aircraft, you know, and the waiter brings the steward. Sorry, the steward brings you a cocktail, of course, and off you go again. Isn't that? I mean, it's just
brilliant. Now, I'm not quite sure I'm as enthusiastic about the potential of being on board an airship like the Graf Zeppelin that you talk about in the book. For some reason, that doesn't appeal to me.
I know why. It's because airships are very short-lived in the history of flight, as you know well.
Yeah.
And the reason is because, you know, of the crash of the destruction of the Hindenburg in the state of New Jersey. Now, that was because, sadly, the German airships, which were the most successful in one sense, is that they could fly the Atlantic, but they were filled with hydrogen rather than helium.
Unbelievable.
And I know. It's because the reason is, and the book explains this on the journey, is journey from Frankfurt to Rio de Janeiro on the Graf Zeppelin airship, which, by the way, is as long as the Empire State Building is tall. I mean,
goodness.
It's a great thing. But just with 20 passengers, you know, in this little gondola, you know, little cabins underneath the big balloon itself. But the aircraft, Zeppelins, because they were filled with hydrogen, you know, if anything did go wrong, like someone struck a match in the wrong place, whoomph, the whole thing went up in a ball of flame, which ran for Hindenburg. But the Graf Zeppelin flew safely. And actually, what the tragedy is, you know what? Why the Americans at the time produced most of the world's helium, and they wouldn't sell it to the Germans because of the Treaty of Versailles and all that First World War stuff and so on. You know, the Germans were the enemy from the First World War. Anyway, the Yanks weren't going to sell them helium, which is quite precious anyway.
Mm.
And so the Germans pressed ahead. But the reason I wanted to do that journey in particular, this is one side of me, is that I write a lot about architecture and design and cities, as well as engineering and travel. But I wanted to meet the famous Swiss-French architect, Le Corbusier, you know, the great modern architect, who some people find difficult still, and some people see as a hero. But he was an interesting man, and he flew on that flight to go to Rio to design some new buildings and to give talks to young modernist Brazilian architects who worshipped him. But what I found through the wonderful Zeppelin Museum in southern Germany is that I could get a passenger list for that exact flight.
There I can see
Monsieur Le Corbusier, you know, on the passenger list, or Herr Corbusier on the list, and there's a spare cabin. And this is why the book, for me, is so enjoyable to write. So I could then put myself, imagine what I would have been like, who would have been like in the 1930s.
Yeah.
I could put myself into that spare cabin. That's mine. So I'm on the airship. That's the conceit of the book. And I'm on that airship. And so I can talk to the passengers. And I know who they are.
Oh.
I know exactly who they are. And including the great architect, Le Corbusier, who I can talk to.
Wow.
And actually, it's a lot of fun as well as being serious, because I get to go and inspect the engines on the of the airship, which means climbing outside, by the way.
Goodness.
Down a ladder into the engine nacelles. The engines were outside, and they had men inside them, you know, tending the engines. And to get to them, you climbed down a ladder on the outside of the Zeppelin whilst it was flying. I mean, it's kind of, you know, slightly mad, Jules Verne stuff, but it's very exciting, huh?
Yeah, absolutely unbelievable. And I can't imagine they worried very much about speedy boarding or how much luggage allowance they had in their overhead lockers in those days.
No, there was nobody saying, "Sit in the upright position," you know, none of that stuff. There were no what I call sky bullies. There were no sky bullies.
Oh, funny.
Telling, can you put your hand right there? Can you put that back up there? Slam Adam. They say Slam Adam just in case they get the sex wrong. These things. All that stuff, and that constant thing. Have you got something to yourself? And you think, please leave me alone. I've travelled the world several times. Not
That's very funny.
And I'm guessing that these airships across the Atlantic must have taken days and would be entirely dependent on any prevailing wind coming in the other direction.
Well, completely, you know, as a pilot, I mean, this is a very, they were huge machines, huge, as long as ocean liners, as long as the great ocean liners, or as I said, American skyscrapers. And so they flew in a stately fashion, so the maximum speed of the Graf Zeppelin or the Hindenburg was about, in miles an hour, you know, about 80 miles an hour.
That's quite much faster than I thought. 80? Wow. That's
really? 80, yeah. So they took about four or five days to cross the Atlantic. And of course, going from Germany across to South America, which is the big route, because Brazil had big connections to Germany economically and later on politically. But they would fly into the wind all the way.
Yeah, of course.
And then coming back, of course, the wind's behind you across the Atlantic. So, I mean, quite something.
Amazing.
But they would, so on the deck, the flight deck, it was like sailing a giant, like sailing a giant ocean liner through the airwaves.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it was. It's an ocean liner in the air, but with very few passengers because, you know, they were designed originally, interesting thing, why so few passengers? Because the Graf Zeppelin was designed as a mail ship, an airship for mail, for post.
Yeah.
So that's the idea, was speed communications between Germany and South America, because the Germans had this big interest in developing South America for lots of reasons, mostly economically.
Yeah.
And later when Hitler came in, you know, politically. But so that's why they didn't take many passengers. Then eventually they did the new designs, and that was the Hindenburg, which took lots of passengers and huge cabins. Double-deck cabins, you know, I mean, beautiful cocktail bars and piano, even a piano up in there, you know, grand piano, but that, as you know, went down and up in flames.
In rather spectacular fashion, absolutely.
And that, that stops it. It's like it's just the end of it, really. And it's a bit like, you know, when Concorde crashed in Paris at the turn of this century, it spelt the end of Concorde, even though that has had, you know, a perfect service record for 27 years in service, but somehow the magic was destroyed because Concorde was the perfect machine, wasn't it? It was never meant to go wrong.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, it's interesting because I was just talking to my friend, and I'm sorry to be a bit boring and aircrafty here, but even if the 737-800 MAX goes back into service, would you fly on it?
No, you don't want to, do you?
No, you don't. No.
And that's it's a very interesting thing because, you know, in this book, you'll see there's lots of loving descriptions of the actual machines themselves, locomotives, cars, trains, ships, planes. I love them all. But why I emphasize them so much is because today we don't often look at them. Do you see, you know, when you get to an airport, you know, and you walk down the gangway, the sealed gangway down to the aircraft, for most people now, they're not, I don't think most people are aware of what the aircraft is.
No.
If you said to most people, say, what is it? They may say Airbus these days because they've heard it said so many times.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't say a 737-4.5.
No.
You know what I mean? So the machine is kind of anonymous. But when the newspapers have a big story about something going wrong, a crash, a fatal crash.
Yes.
Then they do know about it.
Yeah.
And then they will ask that question as they go down the, you know, towards the airplane and say, what is this?
Yeah. And it's written in bold letters on the safety card, isn't it? So you know once you sit down, even if you're not into aircraft, what you're sitting on.
But that's actually interesting in itself, isn't it, what you just said? Because often, and I do it too, you probably do it, because if you're rushing to travel somewhere by a cheap flight, right, you just get to an airport, and I will, as late as possible, because I don't want all the shops and things, I just want to get on the plane.
Yeah.
And so you get on the plane, you sit down, you put on that seatbelt, and then you think, oh, there's a safety card, and I look at it like you do to see what the airplane is.
Yes.
I should do, because it does say 737 and whichever model is. Now, that might not matter to most people. It matters to you. It matters to me, because I'm interested.
Yeah.
But years ago, when we were talking about, you talked about how much you liked watching the steam train as a kid. When a steam express comes into a station to take you to work on holiday, and it's a beautiful, great Western, you know, king-class locomotive, all copper-cap chimneys and brass safety valves and Brunswick green paintwork, and a name, King George V, you know, King Henry VIII. It comes in. You can't miss it, can you?
Sure.
This great dragon coming towards you, mechanical dragon.
Yes.
And people look at them. If you look at old films and photographs of railway stations, it's not just the train spotters who get accused of being anoraks and nutters looking at the engines.
Yeah.
It's everybody.
Totally.
Everybody.
Totally. Oh. Well, your enthusiasm for the subject is wonderful, Jonathan, and the book is great. For that, it'd be a lovely Christmas present for anyone who's interested in transport. The Journey Matters is the name of the book. Jonathan Glancy is the author who we've been talking to. Really appreciate it. And I guess I can now say, because it's December, have a nice Christmas.
And you too. Thanks very much.
Cheers, Jonathan. All the best. Bye-bye.